DiNardo. I'm with the Society of American Baseball Research, working on the Oral History Project. With me today is former Major League pitcher Reggie Cleveland. Reggie pitched in the American League and the National League from 1969 to 1981. Reggie's my guest today with the Equitable All-Stars. They're in town to play the 1980 Philadelphia Phillies, which was the World Championship team. Reggie's going to be playing against that team for the Equitable All-Stars. Reggie, welcome to Philadelphia.
Thanks, man.
You get here much?
No, I live out in Western Canada, so it's got a long ways from there.
Uh-huh, I see. Reggie, I'd like to talk to you for a little bit about some of the things you did during your career, what it was like making the trips around the country with the different major league teams. How does one get from Swift Current, Saskatchewan, all the way to the World Series? Where did you get your start?
Real lucky. No, actually, I was just a big kid, threw the baseball hard, and I was playing, I guess I was 16 years old, I was playing inside the Saskatchewan Swift Current, I guess equivalent of a semi-pro team type thing. And first of all, the manager that I had at the time, he had some contacts in organized baseball, and he contacted the Cardinals and told them, you know, pretty good, you know, young kid that threw the ball hard. About the same time, we were playing in Moose Jaw, Saskatchewan, and there was a, I guess, carnival type deal going through the tour of Canada and play at Frontier Day, something like the state fair, stuff like that. So anyway, guy that had a game on Midway had set up his game and everything Sunday night, and they opened up Monday morning for the week, and he came out to the game, watched the game, saw me pitch, and he happened to umpire spring training games for the Cardinals. So he sent a telegram. So they all arrived about the same time, and so they said, well, I guess we better send somebody up there to look at it. So that's the rest is history.
Mm-hmm. Now, as I recall, the Cardinals had some minor league teams in Canada. I think Winnipeg and Billings. No, Billings is in Montana. Up in that,
yeah,
that northern part of the country. Were you able to hook up with one of those teams?
No.
Did they
no.
send you there?
No, I was. I started off in St. Petersburg under Sparky Anderson, as a matter of fact. And that was 1966. Then went up to Eugene, Oregon in 66, played in the Northwest League.
Mm-hmm.
The next year I started out in St. Petersburg again and hurt my ankle. Didn't pitch for about 6 weeks, and then they sent me back up to Lewiston, Idaho, in the same league as Eugene, the Northwest League. But we had our own team then. The first year it was a combination of Philly and Cardinal team.
Mm-hmm.
Back on that first team, there was four Cardinals on that team, and the rest were all Phillies. And the four Cardinals was Ed Sprague, myself, John Cumberland, and Bill Plummer. And we were the only ones off that team that made the big leagues. We just happened to be all Cardinals for some reason. But in 67, I was in Lewiston, Idaho. And then came back in 68, started off in St. Petersburg again, and finished the season. That had a good year. I think it was 15 and 8 or 15 and 10.
Mm-hmm.
In the Florida State League. Then moved up to Double A the next year in Little Rock. Had a super year there. Moved up to Triple A in 69, and then came up in August of 70 and stayed.
Mm-hmm. When you came up with the Cardinals in August of 70, who was your manager?
Red Chambers.
Red Chambers? What was it like playing for Red?
Red super guy. Super guy. Red let you play. You know, he had a five-man rotation. You started every fifth day. There was no, you know, if you got a rain out, you got pushed back because it was Bob Gibson's turn, you know.
Mm-hmm.
He pushed everybody back, so you always got your start. I think I started 33 or 35 games, you know, somewhere in that area. And, you know, I had good years in St. Louis. It's funny, I played for Warren Spahn in Triple A.
Mm-hmm.
Before one of the big leagues. Saw Warren here today, or yesterday. Played golf with Warren.
Uh-huh. He's a good golfer?
Yeah, he's a pretty decent golfer.
Uh-huh. Was there a young lefty on the Cardinal team with you named Carlton back in those days?
St- Steve, yeah, 69. I watched Steve in 69 when he struck out, was it 70? I can't remember now, but he struck out 19. I was there that game.
Was he hot that night?
He was throwing ball hard, no doubt about it.
I remember listening to that game on the radio, and Swoboda hit him for a pair of homers.
Pair of home runs, beat him, yeah.
Yeah, that was a shame.
Yeah.
So when you were with the Cardinals, had they already moved into the new stadium?
Yeah. No, I didn't play at the old stadium.
You didn't play at the old stadium. Had you played on grass in the minors?
Yeah, oh yeah. The one that, AstroTurf really didn't come in. In fact, when I first went up to Busch Stadium, the Busch Stadium, I think it was like the second year or something when it was open, but we still had grass infields down in Florida, and I think the second year I was with the Cardinals, they put in an AstroTurf infield at Al Lang Field, which I had played at Al Lang, in Florida State League for 3 years, and then they went and changed and made it more concrete, took all the character out of Al Lang Field by making it all concrete. It's really a shame because that was a beautiful, beautiful ballpark to play in for spring training.
Well, what were your feelings on the difference between the grass and the AstroTurf as a pitcher?
I liked it. I liked the AstroTurf. You play deeper. I'd say, AstroTurf, you're going to have higher batting averages. Well, if you really look at it, you have lower batting averages than AstroTurf because you don't get bad hops. You don't get the game is played the same way. You just play deeper. You can play back further on a bunt because the ball's going to get to you a little quicker. Davey Concepcion was amazing. He used to play short left field. A lot of guys, if they couldn't run, he played short left field. You hit a ball to him and he'd gun you out. 200 feet away. So I think all in all, it probably actually hurt batting averages and helped ERAs. Balls in the gaps, they're going to be doubles, but most of the time they're doubles anyway. Balls down the lines are still doubles. They go to the wall. Once in a while, they'll run around the wall and become a triple. But balls down the line in the grass are doubles usually anyway. So I think it actually probably hurt hitting. In the long run.
Now, after the 1973 season, you moved on to the Boston Red Sox team, and over there you had several changes. There was dirt and grass. There was a stadium that was not exactly symmetrical, and there was also the designated hitter. Could you give us your thoughts on what those kind of changes were for you?
I like the designated hitter and the fact that, I'm not a home run hitter and I'm not going to hit for an average. I missed hitting. I liked hitting. I was a good hitting pitcher, but that's not saying a whole lot. I think I hit .212 lifetime or something, which for a pitcher is decent. In fact, I led the Cardinals 1 year into June. I was hitting about .360. About 4 for 11 or something. I like the DH. Now, as far as the pitch in Fenway Park isn't hard to pitch in if you pitch inside for a right-hander. If you try to pitch away because you're afraid of the wall, that's when they reach out and ball into the screen or off the wall. Because it's an easy, a ball on the outside corner for a right-handed hitter, and he pulls it, normally it's a low fly ball to left field or left center. Well, in Fenway Park, that's death. In other parks, it's usually an out. And I was the type of pitcher that got a lot of fly balls. Most of my fly balls went to center field, which in Boston, center field to right center for right-handed hitters is death alley. It's a fly ball because he's way back in there. But if you pitched inside in Fenway and then went away, you had some success. And I pitched in 76. I pitched 170-some innings. I was 13-9 with a 3.07 ERA, which in Boston is like a 2 lot of other places. I only gave up 3 home runs all year. That's amazing when you think about it, because all 3 home runs were in Fenway, And two of those would have been outs, you know, in the other place, because it just made it into the screen. In fact, I can almost remember Don Daler had got me, and he just made it into the screen. Rick Dempsey hit one off me. I can't remember who hit the third one, but I mean, that's for a pitcher, that's, when you think about it, I went, after that year, I went, darn, I didn't give up any home runs, did I?
Now, were there any left-handers on the staff for the Red Sox during the year?
Bill Lee. Bill Lee was probably the left-hander. We had a couple of relievers that were left-handers, but Bill was the starter. And Bill had always had success at Fenway Park. And there again, it's because he wasn't afraid to pitch inside. He'd come in on you, ride a fastball in on you, and then throw a little sinker, a little breaking ball away. Have him hit like fly balls to center field, and ground balls to short.
Do you have any Bill Lee stories? Everybody seems to have Bill Lee stories.
I do, as a matter of fact. The shirt that I got on, this is Glace Bay, Nova Scotia, 1988 Nationals, Little League. Okay, well, my son played on the Prairie representative from Canada, and we went out there, and Glace Bay is as far east as you can go in Canada, and from then on, the next stop is, England. Okay, it's right on the water, yeah. East Coast. And, of course, I live in Calgary, which is right up against the mountains in the West Coast. But anyway, I got out there, and when they found out that I was there with my son and everything, the first thing they did is that said, we're supposed to have Bill Lee come and speak to our group. He said, we haven't heard from him for a while. He says, if we need you, could you come speak at the dinner on Wednesday night or whatever? I said, well, okay. So I got my speech all ready, prepared and everything, because I knew I was going to be the one that was going to be talking. Because Bill, although he, everybody thinks he's an extreme extrovert, he's always fooling around and everything, he's really the other way around. He's an extreme introvert, and he overcompensates. So when he gets in a situation like a speaking engagement or something like that, Bill Lee doesn't show up. Because he just doesn't do it. And I lockered beside him, so I know him. So I knew once I got there, I was going to be making the speech.
How about that? Now, in the 75 World Series, the pitchers had to bat. Did that affect the Red Sox game plans at all? I remember Tiant hitting a double in a World Series game.
I don't think it... It didn't really, because I don't think, like I said, pitchers, I don't care whether you're a National League pitcher or American League pitcher, you're not going to hit anywhere that much. Yeah, you'll get a hit once in a while, and if you're a decent hitter, you're going to get a hit now and then. I got to face Don Gullett. So. He just blew the ball by me. Yeah. I never did see it. But I know it didn't make any difference in the World Series. There's no pitcher got a hit that caused the game to be won or lost or whatever. I don't think it really made a difference.
During the 75 season, you pitched into the League Championship Series and the World Series. Is there a big difference in those games when it gets down to that point? Or is it just a game? Just another one of the games?
No, I think there's a lot of excitement. All the stuff that goes around, along with the World Series. You get 1,000 reporters and everything. You really got to concentrate and keeping your head on straight during the World Series, because there's so many distractions. But other than that, the game itself is another game. You prepare for it the same way. When you're out there, you don't feel any different about it. There's no extra added pressure or anything. It's just you go out there, you do your job. At least I didn't feel anything different myself. It was the whole experience that was the great part about it.
Now, was that your first postseason appearance? Had you made a postseason appearance with the Cardinals?
No.
That was the first one.
First and only.
Now, there were some memorable games in the 75 series, most notably the Game 6. And where were you when the ball went over the fence?
I was out in the bullpen. I had started the fifth game, and back in relief in the sixth game. I didn't get in there, but so I was out there. Got back. I pitched the last out of the series for Boston.
In game seven.
Game seven. Yeah. Still think I should have pitched to Morgan instead of bringing in Jim Burton was brought up. In the middle of August or something. Darryl Johnson went with a left-hander versus a left-hander, but I had pitched against Joe Morgan when I was with St. Louis, and also had a pretty good September for the Red Sox. I got knocked out of game five, but I mean, they didn't exactly, Perez hit two home runs off me, but that was really the only real damage.
Mm-hmm.
Tony Perez can hit two runs off anybody once in a while.
Right.
So, I was throwing the ball, and I thought, I still second guess that part of the game because mm-hmm. I was out there and I was loose and I was throwing the ball well. And I came in, and you know who the last out was?
Tony
Perez.
Tony Perez.
Yeah, I struck him out. So
what did you get him on?
I don't remember now. Yeah. But I know that maybe things might have been different if I'd have come in. A veteran versus bringing in a rookie in that situation. I mean, top of the ninth inning.
Right. What about the
seventh game of the World Series?
Right.
You bring a rookie in there. That
must have been a thrill for him.
Well, I imagine it was, but I imagine he, a little tight, I imagine.
Yeah. Now, what about Darryl Johnson? What kind of a manager was he to play for?
Going to be more public.
Just to Cooperstown. You'll make it to Cooperstown on tape, maybe not on a plaque, but you'll be there on tape.
Well, I don't know. Darryl, the press got to Darryl, I think, in Boston. Darryl and I didn't get off on a good footing right from the get-go. Number one, he took my number. I got traded from Boston, or from St. Louis to Boston. Year I've ever had, really just right there at the point where maybe I'm going to become a 20 game winner, get me and I'm coming out of spring training as a spot starter, long reliever, and that's the pardon my French, but the shit job of the bullpen.
Mm-hmm.
You might get in once or twice a month to start a game, and you only get in the games when you're 47 runs down because the starter can't get out of the third inning.
Well, I believe they traded an everyday player for you.
They traded three. They traded Lynn McLaughlin, Mike Garman, and John Curtis for me.
Mm-hmm.
We traded. I was the main trade, and it was the three young pitchers that St. Louis wanted, and also Diego Segui, who was at the end of his career, and Terry Hughes, a utility infielder, mm-hmm. traded with me. It was a 3-for-3 deal.
What about the pitching coach for the Red Sox during that time? Did Darryl have a number one pitching coach?
Okay, Stan Williams was the pitching coach, and Stan is super.
Yeah, he's super. Still a pitching coach today.
With the Cincinnati.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, no, Stan, I love Stan. Stan's a great pitching coach.
What does a pitching coach do to handle the staff that would take the load off the manager? If Darryl said, "Stan, this is what I want you to do with our pitchers," would Stan take Darryl's instructions, or would Darryl just say, "Okay, the pitchers are yours. I want you to handle them"? How did that work?
It's still ultimately the manager's responsibility, how to handle the pitching staff. Which puts the pitching coach in a bad position, a position that's you don't really have a say, and yet you have some responsibility. So it's a tough situation for the pitching coach. And Darryl, you know, he ran, Darryl's an old, you know, catcher, mm-hmm. so he felt like he knew what how to run the pitching staff too. I think Darryl didn't run a bad pitching staff, he really didn't.
Was Darryl Johnson the manager during your entire stay in
No,
Boston?
Don Zimmer took over in 76, because we went from, a couple outs away from winning the World Series to we were struggling. I think Zimmer took over in July or something, 76. They fired Darryl. And it was basically the thing was, Darryl, the pressure got to Darryl, the Boston media. Put Darryl under.
Right.
Darryl, you'll notice Darryl's never been back managing again. It's because he can't handle the pressure.
Mm-hmm. How about when Zimmer took over? Was there a big change in the team or the way it was handled?
Zimmer's a guy like, he's a lot like Shandy's in the fact that, hey, I don't win ball games, you win ball games. I just got to keep losing. And that's the way I feel like a manager should manage. Managers don't win ball games. Successful managers just lose less than the winning managers. I mean, the losing managers, that's all. It's just a matter of you got to make the right moves at the right time to keep from losing a game. That's what a manager does.
Now, when you were with Boston, there were some great players on the team. Yastrzemski was there, of course, and they also had Fred Lynn in his prime, and Jim Rice. And Luis Tiant was in his later years, but he was a force on the pitching staff. What was it like playing with somebody like Yastrzemski, who was already a legend in Boston?
Yaz is super. I mean, Yaz was Yaz. I mean, he used to bug me. He used to put ice in his red wine. I go, what are you doing? I like it that way, thanks.
From Long Island.
Yes. But no, Yaz, we played bridge a lot together. And, Yaz, his personality was get it done as quick and as easy as possible.
Mm-hmm.
And so we did a lot of three no trump bits. Yaz would go three no trump.
So, you're talking a strange language. I don't play myself. Okay. I know the terms, but I don't quite know what they mean.
Well, three no trump is the lowest number of tricks that you can take to win a game, and it's normally one of the easier contracts. Because there's no trump, you don't have to worry about trump. But Yaz is a super, super guy. He'll do anything for you. Hardest working ball player I've ever seen. Yaz would go out after, have a bad doubleheader and go out and take extra batting practice after the doubleheader on a 100-degree Sunday afternoon. That's just the way he worked.
Mm-hmm.
He worked very hard, and that was the reason why he, did as well as he did and stayed as long as he did. He just had a tremendous work ethic.
Mm-hmm.
Dwight Evans took it from Yaz. Same thing as Dwight Evans' work ethic is exemplary.
That's right.
He does the same thing, and it was basically he learned it from Yaz.
Mm-hmm. How about having Luis Tiant on the staff?
Louis kept the whole team loose. That's Louis' greatest contribution to the Red Sox, I think. Other than his pitching, of course, he pitched well. Pitched super. But Louis kept everybody loose. He was a riot. The big thing in Boston was dump the ice water from the pitcher's where he put his arm, go surprise Louie in the shower and douse him with the ice water.
being a Hispanic player, I don't know how many Hispanic players were on the the staff up there, but did Louis speak English and Spanish?
Oh, yeah. So we had Rogelio Moret,
mm-hmm.
another left-hander. Anyway.
So your days with the Red Sox were over in 1978, and you went to the Texas Rangers. Were you sorry to leave Boston?
No, definitely. I love Boston. In fact, of course, I knew I shouldn't have done it, but I bought a condo in Boston, so I didn't have to rent. Mm-hmm. And of course, as soon as I bought that condo, they traded me.
That's the way it always works. It works that way, yeah. In the business world sometimes,
yeah.
Too.
Yeah, it just became a numbers game. They'd gotten Mike Torres over the winter, so they had a pretty strong pitching staff as far as starters went. Bob Stanley, who's doing a super job in AAA, was out of options, so they needed to keep him on the team. So basically it became a numbers game. Somebody was expendable. Mm-hmm. And the fact that I had pitched well in the last couple of years, basically I was the best trade or saleable pitcher that they had to trade.
Mm-hmm.
So that consequently I left.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a couple of teams in, Texas was interested in me, and so was Milwaukee. And in fact that, Boston didn't want to trade me to Milwaukee because, being in the same division. They didn't want to do that. So Texas brought up the money and said, "Look, we need to do so." Because I think at least this is the story, how the story goes. Harry Dalton was on the plane flying into Boston that morning. The morning I got traded to or sent to Texas, he was on the plane into Boston to trade for me.
Mm-hmm.
That's why I eventually ended up in Milwaukee, because he still wanted me.
Uh-huh. Now, he didn't stay in Texas very long.
No, just a year. Not even a year. I was there from the end of April till the end of the season.
Mm-hmm. Well, was Nolan Ryan on the team at that time? He hadn't quite gotten there yet.
Yeah.
Okay. Then your last years were in Milwaukee with the Brewers, and I think they ended up in the World Series the year after your last season. The following season, they went back to the World Series. You think maybe you could have hung around another year?
Well, they released me in January of '82, and they still had to pay me a couple of years. And at that point in time, I was having a little rough time, family-wise, and it was 11 years in the big leagues. The lifestyle was starting to get to me a little bit. And I just said, well, my arm was hurting a little bit too, because '81 we had that was the strike year, and we were off for 60 some days, and when we came back we had to get ready in like 10 days, 7 mm-hmm. days, 9 days, something like that. And I hurt my arm a little bit. I kind of tore a rotator cuff a little bit, trying to get back into shape too quick. And so I said to myself, well, do I want to hang around? I'll just hang them up. And
mm-hmm. Who was your manager in Milwaukee?
Well, George Bamberger was for the first 2 years, and then Buck Rogers.
Mm-hmm. How were they to play for?
Super, both of them.
George, I haven't heard, is George still healthy, or is he?
I don't know, I haven't heard either. He did go to the Mets and managed them for a while, but I don't think his heart was in it, because he really, I get Frank Cash and they were real good friends.
Mm-hmm.
And Frank lured him back, but I know that George wanted to go to Florida and fish.
Mm-hmm.
That's all he ever talked about. And the Mets lured him back, and I don't think his heart was in it.
Mm-hmm.
That's why he wasn't successful.
Reggie, there was several managers that you played for. Which one would you say you enjoyed playing for the most? You have Zimmer and Shane Dienst and Darryl and George.
That's a hard question. I'd have to say Shane Dienst and Bamberger were the two.
Mm-hmm.
Zimmer's right up there too, though. Zimmer, he was easy manager to play for. If you went out there and gave him 100%, did your job, you had no problems at all. And, he's a player's manager. Shandy's is a player manager. Bamberger is a player's manager.
Mm-hmm.
Daryl was a management manager.
Mm-hmm.
Buck Rogers, I really didn't play for Buck that much. I think the last couple of months of my last year, because he took over from George halfway through. So I think, you know, Buck I know is a player's manager too.
When you left baseball in 1981, did you stay around the game, or did you go to a different career?
I went to a different career and really got away from the game completely. It's funny, baseball, it does that mostly. To most players, it is. Once you're out of the game, you're out of the game. It's a closed society. You know, you eventually get around, like with the old-timers, you're back in it with the old-timers, but we're still separated from, you know, today's player.
What kind of a career are you in now?
I sell real estate.
In the real estate business? It's a very good market to be in.
Well, always get
to talk to people. And
it's up and down.
Well, yeah, it's up and down. But you're always talking to people. It's I always thought that was one of the selling points of the real estate market.
Yeah.
So you never had any ambitions to become a major league manager or a pitching coach?
No. Now I'm thinking seriously about it, though. When I first got out of the game back then, too, the money wasn't that great, especially a minor league manager or something like that. The money was really, really nothing. I mean, an A-ball minor league manager maybe made 20 grand a year. You can't live on that.
No.
But now they're paying a lot better. There's a senior ball. I'm thinking about, I'm going to go down and do that.
Mm-hmm.
So you can stay in baseball year-round. Make enough money to make a decent living.
Mm-hmm.
Before you couldn't. There's nothing. 5 months a year as a minor league manager, or 6 months when you're counting, spring training. It's tough to juggle two worlds. You've got the real world out there where you have to make a living, find a job for 6 months, and then the baseball for 6 months, so it's really tough.
Mm-hmm.
But now you can stay in the game all year round.
If you had to pick an organization, if you wanted to go back into baseball as in management or in coaching or administration, what organizations would be appealing to you?
Well, definitely Toronto. Heard nothing but good things about Toronto. They've always been a super organization. Boston's a great organization, St. Louis also. Texas is still, I don't know, they have problems organization-wise.
Yeah.
They always have, ever since the Corbett days.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know what they're like now. One of the better organizations.
Yeah.
I don't know, Seattle's changed management now. They may become a decent organization.
Mm-hmm.
They always had a bad rep. Organization.
Reggie, I don't want to keep you too long. I just have a couple other questions. In both leagues that you played in, is the umpiring different from one league to the other? Did you see a difference?
I don't think there's a difference in umpiring so much as there was a difference in pitching in the two leagues. The National League is a fastball league, bigger ballparks. Here's the fastball, hit it, see how far you can hit it. You're not going to hit it out of the Astrodome, you're not going to hit it out of St. Louis, you're not going to hit it out of Cincinnati that well. The fields are bigger, and so consequently you don't see as many breaking balls. The American League, because of some of the parks, you see a lot of breaking balls. Seems to be more of a breaking ball league, so consequently the umpiring is a little, it seems like it's a little different because the pitching is different, but I don't think, as far as skill wise or anything like that, I don't think there's any difference. There's good ones and you got bad ones.
As a pitcher, you had to deal with the umpire every time you threw the ball, except for foul balls maybe. Anybody come to mind as somebody that you thought was a good umpire and somebody that you maybe didn't get along with during your career?
Well, I'll tell you one story. Chris Pelikoutis, National League umpire, when I was, I guess, probably, I think it was my rookie year, 71. I forget which team I was pitching for, that he was behind the plate, but I figured it out later all by myself, being a Rhodes Scholar that I am. I was pitching in Montreal, and Chris was just squeezing me. I mean, I had to throw the ball into an area of about 8 by 8 inches square to get a strike. I mean, he's just killing me out there. I'm throwing strike after strike after strike, and he's calling ball after ball after ball, and it is just wearing me out. And found out later that in a game that he had umpired before, before I had, he had missed a strike or something, and I'd stared in at him or said something to him or something like that. And being a rookie pitcher, and him being Chris Pelikoutis, been in the league since God, you know, he said, you know, he was going to get me, and he got me. And he taught me a very valuable lesson. You know, keep your mouth shut and don't show up an umpire. and then the next time he was behind the plate, he was super. He gave me everything, you know, but I learned a lesson.
Don't show up the umpire.
That's right, don't show up the umpire.
There seems to be a trend these days. There seems to be more umpire incidents than there were before, and I don't know what the reason for that is. It could be the nature of the game. Have any comments on that?
It's funny. I was talking to Tommy Jones, who's the manager for the Calgary Cannons, which is the AAA team for the Seattle Mariners. And I've been going out there and throwing batting practice and throwing on the side and working out. But I was talking to him the other day, and he's serving a three-game suspension for the second time he's been thrown out this year, or the second time he's been gotten a three-game suspension. And we were talking about that, and he said he thinks that it has something to do, even in AAA, with the amount of exposure that baseball's getting now on cable, on television, what have you. The umpires are getting bolder and don't want to be showing up as much. So therefore, instead of walking away like they used to when the manager started screaming or whatever, instead of turning around and walking away, they are confronting managers more. I think that's probably has something to do with it. They're becoming more aggressive themselves and saying, look, I'm not going to be treated that way. So it's not so much that there's just as much bitching and moaning from the players and the manager's side. It's just that the umpires aren't taking it as much. So therefore, you're seeing more confrontations. I think that's what's happening.
I basically have one more question, Reggie. For all the years that you've had in baseball, this has always been a big item in Philadelphia. I don't know how it was with you. How would you say you were treated by the press and the media overall?
Overall, pretty well. I probably treated them worse than they treated me over the years. And I think we all have a tendency to think we're better than we are and think that we're bulletproof. And I look back on my career now, and I wish I had done things differently. You know, I wish I had have cooperated more and signed more autographs and, you know, done all that kind of stuff. Because, you know, I look back on it now and you know, hey, I could have been a whole lot more popular ball player, I could have made a whole lot more money, I could have had more contacts, so, you know, the whole gambit of human relations if I'd have just not been such a jerk.
Mm-hmm. You know? Well, I don't recall that you were a controversial player.
Compared to some others, no, but compared to others, yes.
Mm-hmm.
You know? So that's, you know, I'd say, you know, all in all, the press treated me real well. You know, there was a couple of incidences where the press, you know, said things that I had said that I didn't think that they were, you know, anybody in the right mind would put in the newspaper, but, you know, they did.
Mm-hmm.
And upset me, like reporter in Ryan, what was it, Bob Ryan?
It's in Boston Globe,
yeah,
Bob Ryan.
Yeah, he had a quote, or not a quote, but he put in the paper, me and Doug Griffin, we were both struggling. Doug was hitting about 098, and I was giving up home run after home run after home run, not, you know, pitching well at all. And he put in the newspaper that they should, Boston should put me and Doug Griffin on a plane piloted by Amelia Earhart. You know, stuff like this. Another reporter in St. Louis, in Milwaukee, he was doing a Sunday magazine feature on the players about what they, you know, what their secret wish was. So he grabs me after a game that I'd got knocked out of and given up about 8-9 runs, and you know, I wasn't exactly in one of my better moods, and he asked me a dumb question, and I gave him a dumb answer, and of course he printed it, mm-hmm. you know, which caused extreme discomfort to me. Mm-hmm. If the guy had come back into the clubhouse within 2 months of that article, he would have been on the floor. but that happens. Mm-hmm. Sometimes you have to qualify it. You know, I said I should never have said that to start with. Mm-hmm. He shouldn't have published it, but I shouldn't have said it.
Well, Reggie, I don't want to keep you too much longer. I know you want to do some sightseeing around Philadelphia. It's a good town for it. And I appreciate you stopping by.
Thanks, Dan.
And talking with us.
I appreciate it.
Okay. This is Dan DiNardo for the Society for American Baseball Research. It's August the 4th, 1990, with Reggie Cleveland.